Good evening. It's nice to see you. I'm David Goa, director of the Chester Ronning Center, and it's my pleasure to welcome you and to welcome Brian Evans. He's hanging around by the piano because he actually is a jazz pianist in his other life, or at least in his alter ego. And I was hoping he'd begin with that, but Brian graduated from the University of Alberta in 1954, having grown up in, well, outside of Tabor. And as I recall him telling the story, he may say a little bit about it tonight, making very good friends with a child in school who was part of a Chinese family, and spending time in that home, a great deal of time in that home, when he was very young. He got the bug at an early age. He obtained his PhD in Chinese history from the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. Brian is the first one, I believe, to introduce teaching of the history of China and Japan, along with classical Chinese language, at the University of Alberta in 1961. He first traveled to China in 1964 and later served as cultural consular at the Canadian Embassy in Beijing from 73 to 74. So he shares with Chester Ronning that diplomatic hat. Brian met Chester Ronning for the first time in 1965 on Ronning's return from a diplomatic mission to Hanoi. Some of you may be aware of Ronning undertaking that mission on behalf of our friends to the south, if I recall correctly, to see if this is 65, to see if there couldn't be a way of bringing an end to the Vietnam War and not have it heat up anymore. I think of this fairly often because the Vietnam War played a major role in my life. And I think that if he'd been successful, it might have turned out a little bit differently. Subsequently, Brian spent a great deal of time talking with Chester Ronning and recording those interviews here in Camrose, and served as a consultant to the National Film Board on China Mission, the film that was made in 1980. And he's written and lectured extensively in Canada and in China. He's constantly going to China on various aspects of Chinese history and relationships with other parts of the world, and on Ronning's extraordinary career as he works on preparing a biography of Chester Ronning. I have to tell you that one of my reasons for inviting Brian to do these two lectures is to try and light a fire under him around this book, which is there waiting to be born. And I'm so delighted that he's in a position to do this, and it is moving to the top of the pile, I hope. So I'm delighted you're here. Thank you for coming. Welcome.
Good evening, everyone. I'll read my lecture, so if you see my lips stop moving, you'll know I have fallen asleep. I'm grateful to the Ronning Center, and particularly to David Goa, for the opportunity to deliver two lectures on a person who is a hero of mine, Chester Alvin Ronning. I realize that coming to Camrose to talk about Ronning is bringing coals to Newcastle, as the English say. Moreover, it is with considerable temerity that I speak on an aspect of the political history of this district in the home of Professor Roger Epp, whose forbearance now I beg. Because this is the first lecture of two that trace in chronological order two aspects of the career of Chester Ronning, I feel I should give a brief sketch of his earlier years to give proper context. For historians, context is everything. Ronning was born in Fancheng, Hubei Province, China, on the 12th of December, 1894, the first foreign baby to be born in that district. He was the second son of Norwegian-American Lutheran missionaries who had established a mission and a school in this small city on the banks of the Han River, a northern tributary of the mighty Yangtze. Protestant missionaries had begun to enter China after the Second Opium War that ended in 1860 with the Treaty of Tianjin, which allowed legal entry into China of both missionaries and opium. By the time Ronning's parents began their work, the Chinese in the Yangtze Valley were already familiar with Westerners to the extent that there were frequent riots against their presence. In 1899, when Chester was barely 5 years old, the family escaped the uneasy times in their region, arising from the Boxer Rebellion, and took leave in Norway and later the United States. Returning to China in 1901, the family traveled by rail through Calgary, where they crossed paths with Norwegian settlers who had acquired land in northern Alberta. Ronning's parents were persuaded to purchase some too. 6 years later, Ronning's mother died in Fancheng, and Ronning, along with his elder brother Nelius, was sent to Iowa to his mother's family. In 1909, Ronning's father abandoned the mission in China and headed directly for Canada with his five other children. His older sons, Nelius and Chester, joined him from Iowa. As Chester was to describe it, he went from a country that celebrated its independence from oppressive Britain to a land where Britain was the adored mother country. The family settled in Bardo, Alberta, but Ronning Sr., a charismatic preacher, grew restless, and hearing of new land available in the Peace River region, in 1913 he led a group of like-minded settlers over the Athabasca Ice Trail to a place near Grand Prairie, which he called Valhalla. Here he remarried to the eldest daughter of the Horte family, a family that had made the journey with him. In Valhalla, Nelius and Chester were each given a tract of land to break and clear. Chester thought his future was in farming, but he was pressed into teaching the younger children of Valhalla in a makeshift school. Later, he traveled to Edmonton to study at the University of Alberta and to take courses at the Camrose Normal School. He gained a bachelor's degree, launched on a teaching career in Edmonton, joined the engineers, and transferred into the Air Force, serving for a brief period before the close of World War I. In 1918, he married Inga Horte, his stepmother's youngest sister, in a ceremony performed by his father. Inga was born in the United States and spoke Norwegian, but had never been to Norway. Chester returned to teaching and enrolled in a music program in Minnesota. Fate stepped in before he could finish. Although Ronning Sr. had left the mission in China, he retained an interest in the future of the school he had established. He hoped that his eldest son, Nelius, would return to China to teach at the school. Sadly, Nelius, a geology student at U of A, was drowned on a summer survey trip. Chester was asked to replace him. In 1921, he set out with Inga and their first child, Sylvia, for Beijing, where Chester spent a year in language training before going to Fancheng to teach. In 1927, Chester and his family were advised to leave China in face of the growing unrest that accompanied the northern expedition of the combined nationalist and communist forces. Anti-foreignism was running high. Back in Canada, Ronning accepted the position of principal of Camrose Lutheran College, which he assumed in the summer of 1927. He built a house, bought his first radio, and thereafter made and called Camrose his home. Ronning's success as a teacher, choir master, and academic leader is well known in this institution, and it was here, too, that his political career was born. Ronning passed away 25 years ago, but I'm sure that many in this audience have a direct and personal memory of him. For those of you who did not have the pleasure of spending time in his company, let me attempt to give you some inkling of the manner and character of the man as I knew him. First, he was a polymath, a natural at everything he attempted, from sculpting to diplomacy. He was tall, slender, handsome, loquacious, interested in everyone and everything around him, gregarious, a talented public speaker, engaging, trilingual at least, fearless, filled with the milk of human kindness, and funny. I say at least trilingual because in addition to standard Mandarin Chinese, he spoke the Hubei dialect, which in its oral form might as well be another language. In addition, while at Camrose Lutheran College, he taught music, mathematics, religion, and German. A meeting with Ronning was invariably punctuated with laughter and amazing stories of exotic places and extraordinary people. After Canada, he identified most with Norway, but remained attuned to his Chinese background. Thus, he was a proud Canadian with Chinese sensibility, Norwegian calm practicality, and American drive. It's little wonder that his contemporaries thought he might do well in politics. Alberta has become, as is often pointed out by outsiders, particularly those from the East, a one-party state. This unfortunately implies that politics in Alberta are dull. As we all know, this is far from the truth. We have, after all, had our moments. The 30s were a particularly interesting period in Alberta's political history, when world and local economic crises impacted human affairs in dramatic ways. By 1930, Alberta had already had its initial phase of liberal dominance, replaced in 1921 by the political activism of the farm movement. Indeed, in the last years of their power, the Liberals had bent over backwards to please Alberta farmers, whose voice was that of the UFA. The United Farmers of Alberta had chosen to stay out of politics, and to keep it that way, Liberal Premiers Sifton and Stewart did pretty well whatever the UFA, through their leader Henry Wise Wood, demanded. As an example, during a debate in the Alberta legislature in 1920 over changes in liquor legislation, the MLA for Medicine Hat asked, "Mr. Premier, this is a very important act, and I should like to ask if it has had the blessing of Mr. Wood and the United Farmers of Alberta." The Liberals' dependence upon the UFA had become a standing joke. In 1921, the UFA did become political and ran 45 candidates out of a possible 61. They elected 39 of them and formed a majority government. They were said to have no platform, and their leader, Wise Wood, declined to take the job of premier. As one student of the history of the UFA has put it, forming a government had not been the objective of the UFA, whose main goal was to protect and promote the vital interests of its members. At first, they received little respect from city folk, with the joke in Edmonton being that the steps of the legislature should be strewn with straw to make the new government members feel at home. Indeed, the first UFA premier, Herbert Greenfield, was a farmer, said to be leading a diverse mix of agrarian, conservative, American populist, and utopian socialist members. He served until 1925 and was succeeded by John Brownlee, an Edmonton lawyer who had been active behind the scenes from the beginning. Some have argued that despite the personal scandal that brought him down, Brownlee, who was in power until the 10th of July 1934, gave Alberta the best leadership it was to enjoy in the 20th century. It was in the last years of the UFA government and under Brownlee that Chester Ronning entered politics. Ronning was very popular as principal of the Camrose Lutheran College. He built a home just off the campus where he and Inga raised their six children. By 1932, his roots were deep within the community. He was an educator, but he also had political ambitions. As a teenager in Valhalla, he was captivated by the UFA program, and he and a friend made an unsuccessful attempt to nominate a candidate for a provincial election. He was jubilant when the UFA swept the Liberals from power in 1921, but his UFA contacts remained fallow until he returned to Alberta in 1927. In 1930, he put his name forward as a UFA candidate for the federal seat of Camrose. It was reported that Mr. Ronning, in a humorous way, gave a sketch of his life and asked for the cooperation of the people of this district in securing his nomination as progressive candidate for the House of Commons. He lost to the sitting UFA member, W.T. Lucas. Ronning was drawn into provincial UFA politics by the growth in Alberta of a social democratic movement that melded certain parts of the UFA membership with a provincial movement for social and economic reform founded and led by William Irwin, and a national movement led by Henry Shaver Wadsworth, a utopian socialist. These groups, along with labor organizations, met in Calgary in the summer of 1932 to form the Canadian Commonwealth Federation, the CCF, which much later morphed into the current New Democratic Party. In Calgary, they drafted a provisional platform. The CCF, according to Wadsworth, should not enter politics directly, but remain a group of organizations with no individual party memberships. Their draft program called for large-scale nationalization of industry and essential services and government-run programs such as health care, insurance for the sick, elderly, and farmers, and the unemployed. Their aim was to reform or do away with the capitalist system, which had lost a great deal of its appeal with the Great Depression and the onslaught of the Dirty Thirties. That same summer, Vernor Smith, the MLA for Camrose, died. A by-election was called for October 25, 1932. The UFA nominating meeting was set for late September. Ronning won. In his candidature speech, he recounted how he had been associated with the UFA since his early days in Peace River. The UFA had established a government of the province and had established the wheat pools, two great ventures. The aims of the UFA had finally been defined, in his opinion, in the recent manifestos as enunciated in the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation. He felt that the banks must be nationalized along with other public enterprises. Ronning's first steps in the 1932 by-election campaign are best described by himself, and the following passage is from a memoir of China in Revolution, pages 18 and 19. It's a very famous story. In 1932, the United Farmers of Alberta, UFA, asked me to be their candidate to contest a by-election for the Legislative Assembly of Alberta. That summer, the UFA had joined the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation, CCF, headed by James Wadsworth. I happened to be the first person in Canada to run on the provisional CCF platform. Not long after my campaign started, a supporter told me that a very damaging whispering campaign was spreading rapidly through the constituency about me. In his opinion, if I did not stop it, I would not stand a chance of winning against my opponents. I asked my new friend what part of my dark past had been discovered. He said, "They say you were born in China. They also say," he went on, "that your mother was unable to supply you with milk and that cow's milk was not available in China. Is that really so?" From the way he asked the question, I got the impression that he would not vote for me if my reply was in the affirmative. So I had to explain that I had no intention of refusing to give credit to a kind Chinese woman who had saved my life so that I could contest this election as a farmer's candidate. My friend finished by saying, "The worst of it is that they say that since you were brought up on Chinese milk, you are partly Chinese." I interjected that according to that logic, I might have absorbed some of the traditional wisdom of the great Chinese philosophers, which should make me the best possible member of the Alberta legislature to represent the farmers of Camrose constituency. I tried to end our conversation by asking my friend to start a whispering campaign about my opponents. "What do you know about them?" he asked. "I have it on fairly good authority," I said, "that they were brought up on cow's milk." I told this story at every public meeting I addressed after that, and the audience seemed to appreciate the logic. I won the campaign, but I was thrown out on my ear in the next round. The electorate must have decided that I had not acquired the sagacity of the Chinese sages, after all. Much has to be said to explain Ronning's last two sentences, with which he breezily dismisses his political career. Winning the by-election required more than just having a good story to tell. Until his death on the 19th of July, 1932, Vernon W. Smith was Minister of Railways and Telephones, very important in Brownlee's cabinet. He won the Camrose seat in 1921 when the UFA swept to power, winning it again in 1926. In 1930, he won Handley over his only opponent, a Liberal, S.M. Westvik, a farmer from New Norway. Westvik was once again the Liberal candidate for the by-election called for October 25, 1932. He was expected to win, but his chances were put in doubt by the entry of a Conservative candidate, F.P. Layton, a Camrose businessman. The election was hotly contested, with all the provincial party leaders coming out to support their candidates. Ronning's placards encouraged voters to place their trust in him for a number of reasons, the fourth of which was because Chester Ronning is a young man who, through years of active membership in the UFA, is a well-qualified to represent an agricultural constituency. He is thoroughly imbued with the principles of the social, economic, and financial reforms advocated by organized farmers throughout the whole of Canada. He has the courage and ability to fight for those reforms and principles for which our organization stands. The UFOA had a comfortable majority in the legislature, and a loss of the seat would have not greatly damaged them. J.E. Brownlee, the UFA Prime Premier, had not supported Ronning's nomination. He preferred a conservative farmer. So in this case, Ronning was a sacrificial lamb. His candidacy provided an opportunity to test the new affiliation between the UFA and the CCF. He was a UFA candidate running on a CCF platform. The election took place in circumstances not unlike today's, but times then were rougher and more uncertain. The Great Depression had hit Alberta particularly hard. Farmers were hurting from low grain prices and high mortgages. There were high unemployment, with the jobless drifting into the cities and protesting their situation. The UFA government was accused of delaying relief measures while at the same time taking the province further and further into debt. The government in Ottawa was conservative. Its thinking was generally out of harmony with that of the UFA provincially and with UFA members of parliament. Provincially, the UFA's hold on power was weakening, and the press called for a combined Liberal-Conservative alternative. Near the end of the campaign, at a meeting in New Norway, when loudspeakers had to be placed outside for the overflow crowd, both the Conservative and Liberal leaders attacked Premier Brownlee. The Conservatives blamed him for the deficit because he did not follow their advice provincially and ignored the leadership of the offered by Ottawa. The Liberals accused him of spending too much money on the University of Alberta and assigning its president too many commissions, so he was unable to do his job effectively. A major local issue was the fate of the Camrose Normal School, which I believe is now a museum, which Werner Smith had promised would remain open, but which the Liberal leader had said should be closed. Brownlee was being coy about the matter. Ronning endorsed a resolution calling for the school to remain open. Personally, he regarded it as an essential part of Alberta's educational system. On election day, 81.1% of the Camrose electorate turned out. Lines formed outside rural polling stations early in the morning. The roads were dry and good, the weather fine. The voting was by preferential ballot. Voters were to indicate their first and second choices. Ronning received 45% of the first round votes, the remainder being split between his Liberal and Conservative opponents. Ronning had a 560-vote lead over Westbank, but all depended upon the second choices on the third-place Conservative ballots. The election had taken place on Tuesday, but the second choices had to be counted altogether in Camrose once the rural boxes had arrived. It was Friday before the final votes were known. The question was just how many of the latent second-choice ballots would go to Westvik, and would they be sufficient to overtake Ronning? The Liberal fear was that many of the latent votes would be plumped, that is to say, without a second choice indicated. A good number were, and Westvik finished 400 votes behind Ronning. Brownlee expressed his satisfaction with the result, but the Calgary Herald blamed the Conservatives for splitting the vote and allowing the UFA candidate to triumph. The Edmonton press generally agreed that Ronning had won thanks to a split opposition vote. Premier Brownlee, however, attributed the victory largely to Ronning's fine personal reputation. Ronning offered three observations as reported by the Camrose Canadian on the 2nd of November, 1932. First, that governments usually go down to defeat in the times of depression, and the present by-election would indicate that the people of the Camrose constituency still have confidence in the UFA government. Secondly, one of the reasons for victory is that people still hope for the future in the constructive policies of the UFA movement. Thirdly, that the class government argument has lost its effect. The farmers nominated a school teacher, and he was a supporter of the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation, through which the UFA has extended the hand of cooperation to workers in towns and cities, joining them in working for better conditions in Canada. In early November, Chester Alvin Ronning was officially proclaimed a member of the Alberta Legislature for the constituency of Camrose. He now had to get down to work. The Legislative Assembly session opened on the 9th of February 1933, and following the custom, Ronning, a new member, was frog-marched between two government ministers up to the Speaker's chair to be introduced. The very next day, at the request of Premier Brownlee, Ronning made his maiden speech in seconding the speech from the throne. Brownlee advised Ronning to consult the Speaker regarding style and content. Ronning did so, but kept the content to himself. His speech made clear that he was a determined follower of the CCF and one who believed in socialist principles. The Edmonton Journal said that he had made a splendid impression on the House. They reported portions of his speech. "I have come fresh from the people of my constituency with renewed approval of the honest and efficient government which has characterized the present administration, with an expression of confidence in its able leader and with a definite mandate to press for courageous, progressive, and constructive legislation. One could not misinterpret the results of the Camrose by-elections. The issues were clear. The record of the government was capably defended and attacked. The advanced policies of the UFA, as embodied in the recent manifestos, were enthusiastically championed and most bitterly denounced. There was dissatisfaction, but it was dissatisfaction with the capitalistic system. There was feeling that it had outworn its usefulness to man and was in its death throes. There was a desire for change and to a system that would ensure greater economic opportunity for the masses. The formation of the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation had given the people a new hope, new enthusiasm. Never before had the people been so interested in the vital issues affecting not merely their economic welfare, but having a far-reaching effect on their moral, spiritual, and cultural welfare. The people have been rapidly sinking into a hopeless state of mind. An attitude has been prevalent that has been fertile soil for those who seek relief through violence and force. The UFA program has been branded as communistic. The fact is that these policies are the most effective weapons against communist methods. The communists themselves recognize this and correctly regard the forces of reaction as their best allies." In addition to these stirring comments, Ronning emphasized his interest in education, an issue he was to champion in future sessions. He added that he was the first Norseman to sit in the House and so regarded himself as the unofficial general representative for the 40,000 Albertans of Norwegian descent. His speech over, Ronning was taken to task by the opposition Liberal and Conservative leaders. Ronning had agreed to supply the Camrose Canadian with weekly summaries of what was happening in the legislature. In his first report, he summed up the reception to his speech as follows. "The debate on the speech for the throne was particularly interesting to me. The old party leaders used certain stray statements made by me as texts on the basis of which they proceeded to attack the progressive policies of our movement. I enjoyed the paternal spankings as much as they apparently delighted in administering them." But then Ronning had the last laugh. He goes on, "The leader of the Liberals, Mr. Howson, took away all the smart of his sarcastic reference to our home-robbing policy when he stole our thunder and with considerable emotion advocated a federal bank. Another pleasant surprise came when an old Conservative member from Calgary painted a vivid picture of the disastrous results in Alberta of uncontrolled competition and the functioning of soulless corporations. He did it more effectively than any radical thinker could possibly have done." There was another surprise in store for Ronning. When Premier Brownlee called him aside to caution him on the stridency of his remarks, he had his eye on Ronning as a possible Minister of Education. Ronning, however, valued his principles more than the bait he was offered, and he was thereafter considered to be among the small group of radical socialist-leaning members of the UFA caucus. When Ronning took his place in the Assembly, Brownlee had already won ownership of provincial natural resources from Ottawa, and the government had already passed an act to exist farmers faced with high debt. But that act was up for amendment when Ronning arrived. The amendment was to give the act more teeth. A spokesman for the mortgage holders, whose wives and children, according to him, faced poverty, addressed the assembly. It was un-British to punish them in the way the amendment proposed, he said. Ronning, who that morning had received a number of letters from farmers who faced losing their farms after 30 years of effort, entered the debate, pointing out that it was even more un-British to deprive farmers of the equity in their farms after they had worked for decades to stay afloat. The amendment was passed. Back in Camrose, on the evening of Saturday, the 11th of March, Ronning attended a banquet in his honor offered by the Camrose Lutheran Church. 135 people were present. Ronning was asked to say a few words. During his remarks, he touched on the principles of the UFA. He said that he did not deserve the honor being shown him by those present. It was quite fitting, in his opinion, that a banquet on such an occasion should be held in the church, for the church as a whole should be interested in the affairs of government and should take an active part in solving the problems of the day. Back in the legislature, he rejoiced when the estimates for the Camrose Normal School were passed on the 28th of March. As gripping as you may find them, I do not propose to go into any further details on Ronning's first session in the legislature. It is clear that as the House approached prorogation, Ronning, who sincerely believed that all members had the interests of Albertans at heart, was growing tired of the pettiness that was coming primarily from the Liberals. He gained some satisfaction when a Liberal member who tried to make a point of the extravagance of the travel expenses of the UFA cabinet was squelched when the records showed that the travel expenses in the last year of the Liberal government had exceeded the current UFA expenses by $9,699. It was with some relief that Ronning returned to teaching at the college and to conduct a choir. In June 1933, Ronning was named delegate to the Regina meeting of the CCF to draft its manifesto. If one looks at the group photo of the convention attendees, one can see a young 36-year-old Chester Ronning, fifth row back, well left of center, a political position he was to hold for the rest of his life. He returned to Alberta, fired up by the Regina Manifesto and eager to defend the CCF and the House against any further attacks that called it communistic. But the 1934 session of the legislature turned out to be a bit of a damp squib. The press expected little from it and after it was over confirmed that nothing much had happened. Observe the Edmonton Bulletin. The provincial legislature reassembles amid the most serious, the most crucial conditions than have ever afflicted the people of Alberta. It does not promise to be a very cheerful session, but the last way to enter upon a session of this kind is in the spirit of funk. The public will echo the hope expressed in the concluding sentence of the speech from the throne that no ill-considered action of today will jeopardize the welfare of the future. The session over, the bulletin summed it up, it cannot be said that the session of the legislature has been outstanding. Nothing remarkable was done in the way of new legislation. No new lines of important public policy were struck out. During this session, Ronning ceased to provide Camrose Canadian with regular weekly summaries. He did invite his high school class to the legislature to witness it at work. And in early March, he gave a major speech in the House that was critical of the education system. It was a thoroughgoing attack on the content of the curriculum and on the manner in which students were being taught. All subjects should be cast out in history and current affairs emphasized. The current system was rigid and depended upon examinations too much. Teachers were judged on the outcome of the examinations. The examination system had served the past. There was time for new approaches. In the same speech, Ronning once again took on critics who called the CCF communistic. At the end, those around him loudly applauded him. But a reporter covering the speech thought he felt the cabinet looked rather cold. A month later, Ronning gave his full support to a report by Dr. Atkinson on the need for preventive health care to be taught in Alberta schools. Members of the cabinet engaged in a debate over whether or not Dr. Alexander, head of the U of A Classics Department, could be a CCFer. Premier Brownlee stated the government's position that any civil servant could join a political party and work for it as long as he did not take part in election campaigns. To which the Conservative Party leader added that should his party come to power, any professor who had taken part in election campaigns would be dismissed. None of this affected Ronning because he worked for a non-governmental funded institution. But there were more outside concerns for the UFA government, the main one being the growth and strength of the social credit movement under William Eberhardt, a Calgary school teacher, evangelist, and charismatic speaker. Social credit study groups were springing up all over the province, although Eberhardt had denied it was a political movement. He was invited to come to address the Agriculture Committee of the government in March 1934 to explain his ideas. His visit to the committee preceded that of Major Douglas himself, who was on his way from New Zealand and was later to be hired by the UFA as an economic advisor. Ronning was already well briefed on Major Douglas's theories and on Eberhardt's approach. In fact, by March of 1934, those who regarded themselves as the true keepers of the Douglas theories had dismissed Eberhardt for preaching his own brand of social credit. For years, Ronning had listened to Eberhardt's Sunday radio broadcast from Calgary. He had listened as Eberhardt, founder of his own evangelical sect, begged members of the public to buy bricks to build the Prophetic Bible Institute. He elaborated on his theory that the pyramids of Egypt had been built by God and how their dimensions held the secrets of the future of humankind. Then, according to Ronning, one summer when Eberhardt was in Edmonton marking provincial exams, he read a popular novel that was described social credit, and he was hooked. Not in a political sense, according to Ronnie, but in a metaphysical one. He stopped talking about pyramids on Sundays and devoted himself to his version of social credit. A dynamic speaker, Eberhardt attracted a following in Alberta as he promised to reform the monetary system, get rid of the 50 big shots who controlled the banks, and remove the burden of debt. It was a sort of message of hope that appealed to Albertans in desperate times. Parts of it echoed the CCF manifesto. Ronning had studied Major Douglas through books supplied to him by friends in Saskatchewan, but he knew that the social credit had a major flaw. Provincially, it could not control money and credit, which were federal responsibilities. In his presentation to the Agriculture Committee, Eberhardt talked about blood circulating through the body and how it keeps the body functioning, not by having new blood added, but by circulating existing supplies. The same was true of money in the economy, he argued. It was essential to keep money circulating. It was a popular theme with Eberhardt, the blood diagram festooned social credit literature. He went on to explain his concept of social credit, giving due deference to Major Douglas, who was due to arrive in early April. The meeting adjourned, and the members, as was their wont, retired to the lobby of the Corona Hotel, conveniently located on Jasper Avenue to 107th Street. It was a fine hotel, remembered nowadays by an LRT station and a Tim Hortons. Eberhardt was also in the lobby, sitting on his own. Taking pity on him and wanting to point out to him the fatal flaw, the fallacious, a favorite term with Ronning, the fallacious reasoning in the social credit system, Ronning went over to speak to him. He explained that with the dominant government in control, with the Dominion government in control of money, social credit theories could not be successful in a province. To quote Ronning, Eberhardt looked at me, put a flabby hand of his on top of mine, and said, "You understand social credit. Join us. We're going to sweep the province in the next election. I will make you Minister of Education." When the session ended a month later, Ronning returned to Camrose. His return was noted in the Camrose Canadian of April 18, 1934. "Mr. Chester Ronning, UFA member Camrose, has resumed his duties as principal of the Camrose Lutheran College. Mr. Ronning was not prepared to make a statement as to his own personal estimate of the value of the session just closed." Instead, he stated his report to the joint meeting of the United Farmers of Alberta and the United Farm Women of Alberta, meeting in May, when he gave a speech lasting more than an hour. He stressed the inability of the provincial government to carry out many progressive measures in education, health, and other departments due to lack of funds, declaring that the situation could not be remedied to any extent so long as private hands were permitted to control the credit of the country. He admitted having painted a somewhat gloomy picture of existing conditions, but qualified his statements by expressing the thought that humanity is on the march, and eventually, through leadership and education, the necessary changes will be brought about. Ronning was correct. There was a march in progress in Alberta, but William Bibleville Eberhardt was leading it. In Catmrose on July 23rd, he drew an audience estimated at 1,500. He expounded his social credit theories, but denied that he had a plan for the province. At the close of his remarks, his young assistant, Ernest C. Manning, assured the crowd that the introduction of the social credit system in Alberta would not conflict with either the Bank Act or the British North American Act. In the wake of the meeting, a group to study social credit was established in Camrose. The progress of the social credit movement was not blunted much when, in September, the Douglas Credit League of Canada, the self-defined keepers of the true Major Douglas claim, disowned Eberhardt and his brand of social credit. Ronning, meanwhile, continued his own crusade. He addressed the Camrose Inspectorate Teachers' Convention in early October when he asserted that the schools of today are not meeting the demands of modern society. There are, he contended, settlements in Alberta where the teaching of English is deteriorating from year to year under the influence of non-English teachers reared in the community. Secondary education of the future will focus attention on contemporaneous life. The Camrose Normal School should be an experimental school for rural education. The teacher must be freed from uniformed local control and the whims of uniformed opinion. The 1935 session of the legislature, Ronning's last, was not a happy one. At the outset, two UFA members crossed over to the Liberals, and personal scandals overtook three prominent members of the government, Hoadley, McPherson, and Premier Brownlee. In retrospect, Ronning blamed the press and the Liberals for making dirty politics out of the private matters. But no matter, the UFA was daubed with the charge of immorality. The previous July, Ronning had been forced to step down as Premier to be replaced by Reid, a less skillful politician. Hoadley and McPherson had also lost their jobs as ministers. Toward the end of the session, things got so bad that a fight took place just outside the assembly at the top of the marble staircase between McPherson and Charles E. Campbell of the Edmonton Bulletin. The House was debating a bill that was to restrict newspaper reporting in the wake of the coverage that had been given to the affairs of the three UFA cabinet ministers. Ronning was the closest witness to the fight and told the Camrose Canadian Reporter that Mr. Campbell is said to have hurled an unlovely epithet at Mr. McPherson, which caused the latter to exclaim, "No Campbell can call a McPherson that name," whereupon he struck the bulletin manager. Mr. Campbell was unconscious for a period of 3 or 4 minutes. Campbell had, in fact, split his head open when it struck a marble plinth. Such goings-on were fodder for Eberhardt and his radio broadcast, which featured skits called A Man from Mars, and starred, among others, Ernest Manning. Ronning tried to salvage something from the session, giving his full support to a bill concerning the Alberta Teachers Alliance that would incorporate teachers as a profession. The bill went through, but a provision for compulsory membership considered essential and desirable by the teachers themselves was stripped away. During the session and after, members of the UFA, notably Brownlee, gave speeches excoriating Eberhardt's brand of social credit. Eberhardt had originally said that the existing government could implement his ideas, but such a proposal had been rejected by a UFA convention in Calgary earlier in the year. The social credit study groups now became political campaign offices spread throughout the province. When Premier Reid dropped the writ for an election on the 22nd of August 1935, the battle was joined. Ronning had already been warming up with speeches attacking social credit, and further indicating the impossibility of being implemented in Alberta under current circumstances. In early June, Ronning was unanimously affirmed as a UFA candidate for the Camrose constituency in the coming election. He said that if he had not been for the extraordinary situation, he would not have let his name stand. His major opponent was W.N. Chant, the social credit candidate. Early posters for Ronning urged people to vote for him because the government has brought the province through the greatest depression in the world's history, and is appealing to the people for a renewal of their confidence, while chance posters proclaim social credit sets you free. Premier Reid had attended Ronning's nomination, but Ronning also invited Brownlee to campaign with him. In addition, Ronning had the active support of Bill Irvin, Elmer Roper, and Mary Crawford. As voting time drew near, Ronning's placards proclaimed in part, "Vote for Chester Ronning and use the influence of province to urge Dominion to, one, control inflation and the debts can be, so debts can be paid, two, pay insurance for unavoidable crop failure, three, free Canada from the domination of private finance, four, capture right to issue our own credit and secure real social credit. We will do it." To which Chant replied, "Elect a social credit government on August 22nd, cease borrowing from outside sources, obtain a just price for goods and services, end poverty in the midst of plenty, maintain a democratic government, ensure economic security and freedom." In his nearly 3 years in the Legislative Assembly, Ronning had worked hard, reporting regularly to his constituency through meetings, letters, and newspapers, while maintaining his work as principal and teacher at Camrose Lutheran College. But the personal scandals involving three prominent members of the UFA government, notably the Premier, gravely damaged the reputation of the government in people's eyes. No one could say that the government was dishonest, because it was not, but it was seen as immoral. The August 1935 election campaign unleashed the full fury of the social credit movement. Voters in the province, particularly the farmers, were willing to place their trust in Eberhardt and his promises of $25 a month. All he needed, he said, was 100 good men to put the province right. None of the UFA survived. The whole UFA slate was thrown out on its ear, swamped by the social credit tide, which gave 54.2% of the 86.6% voter turnout. It was not for lack of Chinese philosophical sagacity on Ronning's part that he lost, but in large measure because the CCF movement he truly believed in had failed to get its act together as a provincial party, instead of relying upon the increasingly discredited UFA. Well into the future, the CCF was to be associated with the collapse of the UFA. The populism and radicalism that the CCF might have harvested was reaped by social credit, which was attacking many of the same targets while promising miraculous hope and extraordinary benefits to a population worn down by the dirty 30s. Ronning finished a distant third, some 3,000 votes behind Chant. Down but never out, he continued with his CCF work while Chant became Minister of Agriculture in Premier Eberhardt's new cabinet. At a CCF convention in Edmonton in July 1936, Ronning was elected Vice President of the Provincial Association of CCF Clubs. Under Bill Irvin's presidency, Elmer Roper and Mary Crawford filled out the executive. Early the next year, the UFA held its convention amid speculation that it would leave politics altogether. Certainly, the Vegreville Observer encouraged it to do so and added, "As to the CCF, one can only say that farmers, rightly or wrongly, are not socialist, and as a class cannot be persuaded to join the CCF, which is definitely socialistic in its teachings. Mr. William Irvin, ex-MP for Wetaskiwin, is perhaps the best exponent in Alberta of the CCF doctrines, but not even Bill Irvin can make a dent in the fiercely individualistic attitude of most Alberta farmers. Oratory at the UFA convention may carry the day for the CCF, but it does them both, the UFA and the CCF, are wiped off the slate for a long time in the future. The CCF did not take the advice, but began to work for a new program for Alberta. Ronning kept busy making speeches related to the new program and on the growing crisis between Japan and China. In January 1938, he presided in Camrose over a debate among the UFA Labour Party and CCF clubs on the new CCF program. The aim of the program was reported as replace the present capitalistic system by a social order in which domination and exploitation will be eliminated and which equal opportunity for all will be possible. The CCF clubs followed up with a regular series of meetings and debates, and the CCF began to promote itself as a distinctive party with a decision to accept individual memberships and to participate as a party in the forthcoming elections. Finally, in January 1939, the UFA formally withdrew from politics, leaving the CCF a clearer field. CCF constituency organizations were set up throughout the province. In early April, on Good Friday, at a meeting held under the auspices of the CCF to discuss the farm crisis, Ronning avowed that if the efforts of the CCF were consecrated, if we are serious about doing something, not for political advantage, but to solve the problems facing the world today, I know no day too sacred. The spirit of Christianity and of Christian organizations is being threatened by a system depriving the common people of a just reward for their efforts. The principles of today's system rest on an unchristian foundation and one that is inadequate. From the CCF point of view, wars are inevitable under the present setup, with brotherhood absolutely impossible, with nations organized along present industrial lines. Late June 1939, Ronning was once again nominated as a candidate in the next provincial election, this time as a CCFer, running on the CCF platform. In a long acceptance speech, Ronning tied his belief in the CCF into his life story, ending by staunchly refuting any suggestion that the CCF was un-British. The CCF platform states there is no intention of interfering with any religious group or with the rights of minorities. Although the Social Credit had won the Camrose seat handily in the 1935 election, Chant fell out with the Premier 2 years into their mandate and was sitting as an independent. Moreover, an independent unity association had sprung up in Camrose. The next provincial election looked to be interesting. Then, at a CCF meeting in Edmonton in August, Elmer Roper, who represented the labor unions, was named president of the Alberta Party and Ronning its provincial leader. Ronning's years of dedication to the party's ideals and programs had been recognized. E.F. Garland, a well-known CCFer, was reported to have said of the 44-year-old Ronning that if he did not kill himself in the cause, he could become a second Woodsworth. And so it appeared. Ronning set about trying to do just that with a frenetic burst of activity and energy. He went to Ottawa to meet with Woodsworth and the other leaders of the party. On his return, there began a hectic series of meetings as Ronning prepared the party not only for a provincial election but for a federal one as well. He set up study groups, organized petitions, wrote long letters to the paper, issued policy statements, condemned Prime Minister Mackenzie King, and prepared to run candidates in every riding. He attacked the program of the Independent Party in Camrose and issued the CCF program for the province. Moreover, he took to the airwaves, taking a leaf out of Eberhard's book, with broadcasts every Tuesday over CJCA and every Saturday over CFRN. He undertook by car a 4,000-kilometer tour of northern constituencies and later flew down to Calgary and Lethbridge to tour the south. He was in my hometown of Tabor on the 16th of March, 1940, but being only 7 years old at the time, I did not attend. Ronning grew more and more confident of the CCF chances in the provincial election. The CCF ran 36 candidates, hoping for the level of success the party had achieved in BC and Saskatchewan. It was stressful and exhausting work because it meant long meetings, innumerable speeches, a great deal of travel, late nights, and time away from his home and family on top of his job as principal. With the provincial and federal elections close together, the provincial one was the 21st of March and the federal one the 26th, the CCF and Camrose ran ads featuring both Ronning and Sigurd Lefsrud, the federal candidate. Ronning was up against J.D. Neville, the independent candidate, and D.B. Mullen, the new candidate for Social Credit. In the dying days before the late March vote, Ronning was faced with comments circulated by both the Social Credit and independent campaigns that a vote for CCF would mean a government the same as that in Germany. In the end, both Ronning and Lefsrud lost, but Ronning came within 74 votes of Mullen, the winner. Ronning thought the results were good, considering how recently the CCF had entered as a party, but the Camrose constituency was not finished with Ronning yet. Post-election, he slowed his pace, consolidating constituency organizations that had been put in place before the election. He was able to take a break in June to go to attend the convention of the Lutheran Church of America in Minneapolis and to watch his father receive an honorary degree from St. Olaf's College. On his return, he continued to advance the cause of the CCF and to expound further his views of education. In November, fate stepped in with the sudden death of Mullen, the Social Credit MLA. Pressure was put on Ronning to run again in the by-election. He was nominated unanimously on November 23rd at a CCF convention, and he geared up for yet another battle. Premier Eberhardt suggested there need not be a battle at all, since the death of a Social Credit member had made the seat vacant. It should be filled by acclamation. This brought a laugh from the editors of the Vegreville Observer, who commented, "There will be an election in Camrose, all right, unless Mr. Ronning, the CCF candidate, should unhappily overeat and pass out during the Christmas festivities." Social Credit chose C.I. Sayers, a farmer from Meeting Creek, and set the date for the election on the 6th of February, 1941. This time, Ronning's posters proclaimed, "Follow the lead of Britain, CCF policy identical with British Labour Party," with some of them finishing with "God Save the King." But it did not work. In the two-way fight, Ronning finished 546 votes behind. Beaten but unbowed, Ronning proclaimed, "As soon as there's another election, we'll contest it, for CCF is a crusade. But members of the press advised Ronning and his colleagues to give up on the province and to concentrate on the Dominion. Instead, Ronning took on Neville, the former independent candidate, in a war of words in the letter columns of the Camrose Canadian, accusing the independent of not being independent at all, but having made pro-government statements before the election that affected the outcome. Nothing was gained. As if for a diversion, Ronning took his college choir to Edmonton, where they received exceptionally high marks and high praise, and he worked on a master's degree from the University of Alberta. He maintained his schedule of speeches and radio talks, but with the worsening situation in Asia and in Europe, one detects a certain restlessness within him. Late in January 1942, he was unanimously chosen president of the provincial CCF, and he presided over a reorganization of the provincial party. In a broadcast in April, he indicated that it was necessary to vote yes in the coming plebiscite on conscription, something that Camrose and all Alberta did. In June 1942, when the RCAF recruiters passed through Camrose, Ronning offered his name, and shortly thereafter happily handed over his CCF duties to Elmer Roper, who had just won a by-election in Edmonton. He could not have continued in any case because he had been called to rejoin the RCAF to work in Ottawa decoding Japanese radio messages. With his newly awarded master's degree, he took a leave of absence from the college for the duration of the war. Yet he would come back to Camrose for one more stab at politics, allowing his name to stand as a CCF candidate in the June 1945 federal election. Taking a brief leave from his duties in Ottawa, he campaigned by radio and made a limited number of stump speeches before flying off for obligations in England. Again he lost. By VJ Day, August 1945, he had a choice to make. He could return to Camrose and the college, where he was aware of unhappiness within the board about him, or he could accept an offer from the Department of External Affairs for a one-year posting to the Canadian Embassy in Chongqing, China. He chose the latter. Ronning was a socialist and made no bones about it. He believed that his father was one too, although his father shied away from the term. Both in China and Canada, Ronning spent the first half of his life in unsettled times. Revolution was brewing in China during his childhood and was more directly evident when he went back to teach at his father's school. His students and teachers were actively participating in the communist directed rural uprisings. In his youth in Valhalla, he was taken with the radical message of the United Farmers of Alberta well before they turned to politics and formed a government. When he returned to Canada from China in 1927, he revived his links with the UFA. Later, he joined the CCF and helped to shape its policies because he firmly believed that the capitalist system was wrong and that no reform could be accomplished until it was abolished and a system of shared responsibilities and a government dedicated to the needs of the ordinary people was established. Although he knew some labor union people to be socialists, he regarded unions as part of the capitalist system, created as a reaction to it. Labor unions were out for their individual members, not necessarily for the whole of society. He kept to his and CCF principles not only throughout his political career, but they informed his action and his career in general. He gave his all for the development of the CCF in Alberta, yet the summaries of his life in books and government handouts omit this phase of his life. Except for the inner circles of the NDP, it remains virtually unknown. In his 80s, Ronning spoke of how we in Western democracies continue to elect the wrong people to serve in government, and that so much of what is essential to our daily living is in the hands of people over whom we have no control and who are not elected. Despite this, he remained optimistic to the end that his type of socialism would eventually be realized. In looking back over his life and the role that his time in Alberta politics played, he concluded that this experience enabled him to understand the Chinese Revolution in a way he could not have done without it. But that's the tale for next week. Thank you very much. Yes. Good question. I'm sure that many people in New Chester, you have questions. No one with relatives who ran against Chester Ronning? Yeah.
I wish I had to say that. My question is, how is Ronning perceived by his contemporaries and other politicians? How is it individual politics?
That I can't give you a direct answer, but he was participating always in CCF conventions and others, and Tommy Douglas was to do very well in Saskatchewan, and Woodsworth and the CCF became the official opposition in British Columbia. That's why when Ronning was running, he had anticipated, he had hopes that it would become the opposition in Alberta. And Woodsworth, who became the federal member from North Winnipeg for the CCF and as leader of the Dominion CCF from 1921 till his death in 1942, always had that hope as well. But Woodsworth was a very pure pacifist socialist, and he did not approve of the referendum, of the plebiscite that Ronning approved of conscription, and he was against the war. But I don't know exactly how he was perceived by others. You don't see much comment by others of him, but he was unmistakable. How could you ignore him? He was fired up. I mean, he was a terrific speaker, so, you know.
Yeah, you mentioned that he knew that the board of CLC was not going to be happy. Was it because of his many actions or because of his policy?
He didn't make that clear. This was in an interview. He just said, I could have gone back to the school, but I knew that somewhere on the board weren't really happy with me. I would imagine, given the pace he was doing, they had two counts on him. One, that he wasn't doing his job as well as long here as he should be, as paying as much attention. And the other, there would be conservatives who were not quite happy with his socialist message.
Did he speak to you about that to any great extent?
Not to any great extent, no. And a lot of this, some of the things I've had here, particularly the Eberhardt story, is from an interview, a three-hour interview we did with Howard Leeson. I was at the archives listening to that the other day. It was wonderful. It was like spending 3 hours with Chester. I mean, it was 83 at the time when he made it. He had tended to drift off a little bit, but he was full of wonderful stories and things. Yeah, he said in one of the debates in the legislature, there was a wonderful put down by a lady member of a very windy male member, and the lady member said, "The honourable member leaves no thought unuttered." But he was really, really a crusader on education, and I don't think anything's been done about that either. I think Ronning's ideas and the role he played in progressive education in Alberta hasn't been investigated very fully. Well, I would have to trace the graduation list and see who went on to do what, probably as a direct influence. But he was, you know, he was a principal at the 25th anniversary. He did the sketches for the program. He did the drawings for the program for the 25th anniversary. He was lauded by students all the time when he came back. And of course, the choir was doing extremely well. So he was, I don't think his popularity among his students was undiminished at all by his other activities. And they probably, you know, looked up to him for that. I'm old enough, but young enough to remember Eberhardt and the grip he had. Now, Eberhardt in the next election lost a lot to independents because he was such a strange guy, to put it mildly. And his wife refused. He died in B.C., on a trip to B.C., and his wife refused to let him be buried in Alberta because she felt the Albertans didn't appreciate it. And if there's anything, if my father was anyone to judge by, he appreciated him, all right. my father, I come from very poor circumstances. My father wrote to Eberhardt asking what happened to the $25 a month. And Eberhardt replied, "Be patient," which didn't put food on the table. And there are hands there, so, yeah.
Mr. Roberts, if he is half the CC effort, would he be a full-time Australian government?
I think Chester could have been a lieutenant governor because when he won the when he was awarded the Order of Alberta, the Distinguished Order of Alberta, there's no mention of his CCF past at all. And Peter Lougheed's spouse, wife, comes from Camrose. She was a great fan of Chester's. Chester was on the board of governors of the thing, so he could easily have become. After all, Trudeau chose. CCF, former CCF Premier of Manitoba as the Governor General. So Ronning was distinguished enough and what I'll talk about next week was his international reputation as a diplomat so submerged anything of this, yet he still retained his socialism and that's one of the complaints about neoconservative writers, political scientists and others about the Canadian Department of External Affairs in those days, about the left-wingers overbalancing the power, overbalancing policy. But no, I think, he could have been. But his, and I'll point out next week, he was too late in a sense because he was already, 51 in 1945. And it was he was getting on, and he was allowed to stay on in the Foreign Service a little longer than usual in order for him to get a pension, a proper pension. But I say I met him in 1965 when he came back from Hanoi, and the energy of the man was just incredible. And he was still, he spoke to my classes, he would come and speak to my classes, he would install them, there would be no problem. I have lots of good running stories beyond that, but he would have done Alberta proud as a lieutenant governor. There's no doubt about it. He was every bit a Grant McEwen style person, and I would have thought somebody like a law he would have done it, but it was just not. Those years he was not quite. As sharp as he could be.
You mentioned the banquet in honor at the church.
Yeah.
In your conversations with him, did he ever reflect at all on his faith in religion to his?
I think he said that his father was a Huygian. And that's why he felt that socialism, his father's socialism, became that, and he embraced it as well. So I think he found that quite compatible. There was no problems whatsoever with this, and I don't think he ever saw any conflict between his his belief and his belief in the, in socialism.
But, well, the one quote you had as well about Christianity being has to be engaged.
This
is so un-Christian what's going on.
Yeah.
I mean, this strikes me as very much out of certainly the kind of socialism my father had. I heard my father argue at a table with many, many other Lutheran friends that you simply can't be a Christian and a capitalist. I mean, he was so firm about this. Led people to tears.
Oh, sorry.
Pretty.
That he was highly respected among the students. I would not say that he ever preached politics in connection with his services. Possibly the influence was by osmosis. And there was a bit of amusement circulating around the fact that during one of the election campaigns that were going on in the 30s, the son of the Social Credit, or I'm not sure about Social Credit, but the son of our local MP in Ottawa was Ronnie's enthusiastic little helper to carry in the boxes of leaflets and so on to the political meetings that he had. So I don't know that he had an influence in a political way, but the students loved him.
Thank you.
It was an MA in a sense in education, and it was about the development of the Camrose Lutheran College. It's available on the shelves in the Coutts. Yeah, here. It's also at Coutts in at U of A. Yeah, yeah. But I just found that knowing how difficult it is for students to get master's theses done, that he was doing all this and still doing a master's, it was quite astonishing. He told a story too about as a sculptor. M.J. Caldwell, he did a bust of M.J. Caldwell, and Caldwell liked it, so he gave it to Caldwell. And Caldwell told him the story that one day Caldwell was away from the home, but his granddaughter came in and rushed up and hugged it and said, "Grandpa."
Thank you so much. Lovely to
see you. You're welcome.
Forward to next week.
Thank you.